alweer een bijzonder fijne avond gewenst, dames en heren, hier in de enige zaal die het toe doet, zoals de Nacht van de Vrijdag. U hebt het natuurlijk allemaal door, u bent bijzonder intelligent. U weet hoe u beslissingen maakt en u weet hoe andere mensen u proberen te beïnvloeden. Daarom hebt u er natuurlijk volkomen zelfstandig voor gekozen om nu hier te zitten en niet op een prikkelend, maar laten we toch ook eerlijk zijn, misschien een klein beetje saai debat over vrije wil en het strafrechtssysteem. We hebben iets veel beters voor u in petto, dames en heren, maar ik moet u eerst even waarschuwen. Er werd mij verteld dat sommigen onder u drankjes mee binnen smokkelen. En iedereen steekt ze nu weg. Nee, dat mag, dat is geen enkel probleem. Als u maar gewoon op het einde van het verhaal uw glas ook weer mee terug naar de bar neemt. Er zijn hier zebras gespot die hun tere pootjes daaraan zouden kunnen bezien. De man die ik moet aankondigen heeft het eigenlijk zelf al geweldig gedaan met de openingsslide van zijn presentatie. Nu kunt u hem ook al gewoon rechtstreeks contacteren. Dus wat is mijn rol hierin? James Garvey gaat u vertellen hoe een gigantische industrie van vervelende marketeers erin slagen om het dagelijkse leven van u en ik tot een hel te maken of ons althans in bepaalde richtingen te proberen duwen. De ins en outs krijgt u van hem te horen. Laat u niet langer wachten. Uw hartelijk applaus voor James Garvey.
Thank you for what I assume was a very kind introduction. Could say anything, I have no idea. But thank you very much, thank you for coming. I can't imagine a room full of people in London at 10, 11 o'clock at night talking about philosophy and persuasion, but I'm glad that you're doing it, that invitation. So let me just get straight to it. I think we're in the middle of a revolution in persuasion, a kind of change in the way human beings alter each other's mental states or attitudes. I think that we're moving away from reason and praising facts and evidence towards something else, something that operates outside of reason. And when I first became interested in persuasion a few years ago, it was more or less a curiosity. You know, what are the dark arts as practiced by propagandists and marketers and advertisers? And given events over the last few months, I think persuasion matters a lot, and the place of reason in human life matters a lot, and it got really serious on me when my fellow Americans elected Trump and when my home adopted country voted to move out of the European Union. How arguments and the role of reason in public life matters a lot now, and it's become a serious thing to me now, whereas before it was just kind of interesting. But let me tell you why I think we're somewhere in the middle of a persuasion revolution. I'm totally going to fall off this because I knew where I'm at. I think the simple answer is human beings started studying inferences and influence and deception and argument, and we got really good at it. Sometime around the middle of the last century, maybe around the Second World War, people started to understand how propaganda works and understand how attitude change works, and we're now extremely good at how persuasion works. Let me give you some examples from the more bizarre end of persuasion research. Your political views will tilt in a conservative direction if you're asked about them in close proximity to a hand sanitizer. You're more likely to believe people if they share your initials, or your mother's maiden name, or your date of birth. You will go along with propositions spoken into your right ear rather than your left ear. In one study, just the description of something can be persuasive. So in one study, people were given the same food cooked by the same person, the same recipe. In one group was told it was baked fish. The other group was told it was succulent Mediterranean baked fish. And the second group would pay more for it, would recommend it to friends, thought it tasted better, all that stuff. We like short sentences. We believe short sentences. We like simple words. We like clear fonts, clear websites. fonts. we're persuaded by words or phrases that scan well or that rhyme. Right? I know this thanks to a really good study called Birds of a Feather Flock Conjointly. There's all sorts of things we now know about persuasion, and it's big business. But
in your ordinary life, you will encounter hundreds and thousands of persuasive messages each day, depends on how you count it. Almost none of it consists in giving you good reasons or giving you an argument or giving you facts and evidence. Just to pull some words out of the air for you, instead of an argument, you're going to hear things like decoy pricing, viral marketing, astroturfing, crowd manipulation, newsjacking, framing, spinning, propagandizing, agenda setting, message discipline, anchoring, emotional appeals, nudging, all of this in an effort to get you to change your mind about something. How did we get here? In a few sentences, I'm interested in the history of persuasion, but in a few sentences, one of the things that happened was press agents, before the Second World War, the First World War, were just interested in giving the facts about the company that they represented. When they went to war and became propaganda people, they came back as public relations professionals. And I've got no huge objections to public relations. Some of it's awful. And some of it, in the business of corporations, did things in the States, like changed our conception of corporations. Instead of ogres, they became friendly giants. And sort of capitalism, free enterprise, was elevated up there with freedom of religion and freedom of speech and freedom to gather. There's also changes that have to do with advertising, obviously. Advertising 200 years ago, 100 years ago, was just an attempt to say what was available where, how much it cost, and what it was. And in the 50s, Freud appeared on Madison Avenue. And now an advertising team knows a lot about psychology and understands what makes us tick and knows how to get buying behavior activated in the human mind. An advertisement now is this amazing narrative that pulls your heartstrings and changes your mind in all sorts of different ways. It's not just factual. Metaphor and understanding metaphor and the power of framing is now a big part of our political discourse. I'll talk about that in a second in more detail, but any politician who knows what they're doing will know a lot about embodied cognition and the power of framing and metaphor. Behavioral economics is now a big part of how governments operate. So nudge theory, in a couple of sentences, nudging just is the idea that you can structure the choice architecture in which you make decisions in such a way that you will be nudged in socially responsible directions. The idea is that behavioral economics shows us that we're not just rational creatures, that there's all sorts of cognitive biases and heuristics and blind spots. And if you have an understanding of those, you can tilt people towards doing things. I read a study the other day that said nudge theory was a part of centrally orchestrated government policy, or government policies influenced by nudging in over 140 countries. It's a big way that governments are now influencing their citizens. Neuroscience and neuromarketing is another part of it. The amount of effort that goes into designing a shop, right, or designing the products that you might touch in a shop is enormous. People have brain scanners and eye software that tracks your vision, and wander around shops and work out where the really good spots are to put things, because that's where the eyes go. The same thing happens on websites. The entrance to a shop is called the Gruen transfer. The next shop, big shop you go into, look for it. So the entrance is wasted space from a retail point of view, because it takes a human mind a little bit of time to move from the analytic mode that you're in when you're looking for the shop entrance and moving through the city to that slow browsing mode that you're in when you're shopping. So the first few meters are useless. So they have to do something with that space, so they put stuff there like a big sign that says sale, or newspapers that might stop you. Some shops are intelligent. They try to blur the distinction between inside and outside and put things outside to get you shopping before you get in there. Anyway, there's a lot of effort that's been put into why shops look the way they do and why products look the way they do. So all of these things, I think, are part of the persuasion revolution. And our minds are changed more often by things that aren't good reasons. And I think that's changing us. I think that's changing our politics. And I'll try to talk about that a bit in a second. But first, I want to give you some examples from the modern landscape of perception. I'll start with framing. So everybody since the dawn of time has known that how you put your words, what words you choose, makes a difference to who listens and who doesn't. But framing effects have only recently been studied, maybe since like the 1980s. We still don't really understand what's going on, but it turns out that certain words seem to emphasize some aspects of a concept and others don't. So particular words will push your mind in one direction rather than another. There's a really interesting study. There's a thing called the U.S. General Social Survey. and it's been asking people the same sorts of questions, well, exactly the same questions for decades about certain policy matters. They say, are we spending too much, just enough, not enough on, say, welfare or whatever? So we've got this really big database of what people think in response to these questions. And what researchers did to sort of measure framing effects, they asked them slightly differently worded questions. In some cases, they just added verbs to see if that would change people's opinion or sway public opinion. And they did. I'll give you some examples. They found that there was much more support for protecting Social Security than Social Security. There was more support for solving the problem of big cities than assistance to big cities. The biggest shift was bizarre. 20% thought that too little was spent on welfare. 65% thought too little was being spent on assistance to the poor. It's the same thing,
right,
worded slightly differently. I'll give you an example, if I can make this work. I'm going to give you an example. I'll read something to you. You can look at it, and I'll ask you a question. This is from the study on framing effects. Try to think of some answers. So here's the sentence. Crime is a wild beast preying on the city of Addison. The crime rate in this once peaceful city has steadily increased over the past 3 years. In fact, these days it seems that crime is lurking in every neighborhood. In 2004, 46,177 crimes were reported, compared to more than 55,000 reported in 2007. The rise in violent crime is particularly alarming. In 2004, there were 330 murders in the city. In 2007, there were over 500. So the question is, what should we do about crime, in your opinion, in the city of Addison? Think about it. Well, one group saw this, and the answer is, it's the same thing. One group saw this. And the answers that they gave, 75% thought that something to do with policing, calling in the army, jails, was the right thing to do about crime. Just 25% answered, well, maybe we should do something about sort of encourage the economy in the area, or do something about education for children, give them something to do, a sort of social reform. A second group saw this version. Crime is a virus infecting the city, plaguing every neighborhood. Not a beast, but a virus. The numbers changed a lot. Instead of 22%, instead of around 25%, it was 44%. Now thought about social reform. And it was a corresponding drop in people who thought policing was a good idea, or calling the army was a good idea. And the researchers think what goes on is there's a kind of structurally consistent inference happening in your head when you hear about crime as a beast. Think, lock it up, hunt it down, cage it up, do something with it like that. If you think of crime, you're presented with crime framed as a virus plaguing the city, you think of something more holistic, some sort of something that'll heal the problem, some way of nurturing it. Amazingly, then people were then asked, why did you make the decision that you made when you saw this? What led you to the conclusion that social reform was needed? Or what led you to the conclusion that more policing was needed? Most people, a large percentage, said it was the numbers. 46,000, that's a lot. We've got to do something about that. 3% said, well, maybe it was the metaphor you used. Right? So there's a way that you can change people's minds about big political questions just by the words that you use. And that, irritatingly, is the real power of spin on us. You and I rightly roll your eyes when a politician says something painfully idiotic that's clearly spinning, not answering a question, just spinning the way that they want it to go. The sentence you get in London all the time is, let's be clear, let me be clear. That's what he's not going to be clear. That's not what's about to happen. But it works. It works on us. And people who know what they're doing, politicians who know what they're doing, spend a lot of money polling people, working out what tilts public opinion in the direction of a conservative view or a liberal view, depending upon who they are. The master of this in the States is this guy, Frank Luntz. So Frank is a pollster, and he advises Republicans and conservative politicians. And what he works on is words that will get you support for conservative policies. And he produces pamphlets that conservative politicians are meant to have a look at and use during election cycles. And he tells them, these are the words that work if you want people to believe Republican propositions. I'll read you that one of them. There's an appendix called 14 Words Never to Use, and I'll read you some of them. By the way, he describes this as 14 words never to use because effectively communicating requires you to stop saying words and phrases that undermine your ability to educate the American people. It's like spinning. You're educating the American people, you're not manipulating them in a reasonably horrible way. So Americans might actually support their local government, they might like their state government or their city council or whatever. So if you're making a critical point, always say Washington. And don't say government. That people will go along with attacks on Washington, but maybe not government. Personalizing is better than privatizing. Americans worry that tax reform might result in their paying more tax, but almost everyone is in favor of tax simplification. A narrow majority would repeal inheritance tax or estate tax, an overwhelming majority of people would vote against a death tax. Never talk about drilling for oil, these are his words, when you can explore for energy. Awesome. Never refer to undocumented workers when you can say illegal aliens. Do not address immigration reform. This is good. Do not address immigration reform, which polarizes Americans, when you can instead use the words border security. Because everything's going to clap. We hear these all the time now. I mean, if you listen to the news now, you hear this all the time. Some people will say migrants as opposed to immigrants as opposed to refugees. There's a big debate in the UK about gay marriage as opposed to same-sex marriage as opposed to homosexual marriage. People who know what the words do will choose their words accordingly if they know what they're doing. In the United States, it wasn't torture. There were enhanced interrogation techniques. It wasn't a war. It was a military action. I mean, again, we scoff at it, but it works on us. It does work on us. Let me switch now to a second thing. This is in the news now. A lot of this material is new to me. So at the moment in the States, there's a big discussion about not just the language that we use, but the actual news that appears to us. So you might know Facebook is in a huge amount of trouble. 63% of Americans get news in some way from their Facebook feeds. I imagine that's true for all of us. So the problem in the States was what was called fake news. I call it propaganda. It's nothing new, really. What's new is the method by which it's spread around. Sites producing fake news stories were often set up to look very much like credible sites. The URLs looked very similar, so it wasn't like abc.co, it was abc.go.com. They were designed to look very much like, you know, to the casual observer, that it was just a normal website, and it wasn't. And they often just appeared a few days before their stories went viral. The stories... This is a graph from BuzzFeed, I think. So, I'll read you the quote. During the final 3 months of the U.S. presidential campaign, 20 top-performing false election stories from hoaxed sites and hyper-partisan blogs generated 8,007,100 shares, reactions, and comments on Facebook. Within the same period, the 20 best-performing election stories from 19 major news websites generated a total of just 7,367,000 shares, reactions, and comments on Facebook. People were sharing fake stories more than they were sharing real ones. Of the 20 top-performing false election stories identified in the analysis, all but three were overtly pro-Donald Trump or anti-Hillary Clinton. There's a thing I just read on the train on my way here today, a study in Stanford, this was in The Guardian, showed that children of school age found it very difficult to distinguish between fake news and real news, and very difficult to tell when something was from a credible site and when it wasn't. It just goes in. One of the examples was a clearly photoshopped image of a flower with double head on it, and it said, "Flowers blooming in Fukushima, don't look right." And it was like, if you look at it, it was like, that doesn't look right. And if you examine it, you could probably work out that it came from an untrustworthy source. Or you could just click share. And that's what people are doing. They're just clicking share. Here's some of the stories that people were sharing. And the two biggest stories claim that Clinton sold weapons to ISIS. The Pope endorsed Donald Trump. Another had it that the FBI agent responsible for the leaks of Clinton's emails was found dead. Hillary Clinton had him killed. This is a headline. Donald Trump protester speaks out, "I was paid $3,500 to protest Trump's rally." Another headline, Obama signs executive order declaring investigation into election results, revote planned for 19 December. Whatever you think of all this, it might have had an effect on the election. Millions of people saw and shared this, and they were persuaded by a lot of it, and they weren't sharing real news, or they weren't sharing it as much. The third thing I want to talk about, and I'm going to do something unprecedented in human history, I'm going to try to launch a YouTube video from a PowerPoint presentation. This may not work, and if it doesn't, I'll just describe it to you. But in the autumn of 2011, about half the teachers in the UK and a good chunk of the civil servants in the NHS were on strike, and Ed Miliband was the Labour leader at the time. He was expected to beat David Cameron. That's the third upset. No, the first upset no one talks about. It was Trump and Brexit, but the Conservatives won by a huge margin. They were supposed to have lost in the UK. So Labour leader Ed Miliband responds to this crisis in an interview, and I'll play you some of the interview. This is a pool interview, so this isn't how it was broadcast on television. The way it works is a freelance reporter gets asked by the BBC to interview Miliband and get a reaction on the strikes. He's given a few minutes with Miliband. And this is, let's see if this may work. And this is the result. It looks like it might work.
These strikes are wrong at a time when negotiations are still going on, while parents and the public have been let down by both sides because the government has acted in a reckless and provocative manner. After today's disruption, I urge both sides to put aside the rhetoric, get around the negotiating table, and stop it happening again.
I listened to your speech in Wrexham. You talked about the Labour Party being a movement. A lot of people in that movement, people are on strike today, and they're really looking at you and thinking, well, you're describing these strikes as wrong. Why aren't you giving us more leadership as a leader of the Labour movement?
At a time when negotiations are still going on, I do believe these strikes are wrong. And that's why I say both sides should, after today's disruption, get around the negotiation table, put aside the rhetoric, and sort the problem out. Because the public and parents have been let down by both sides. The government acted in a reckless and provocative manner.
Well, I spoke to Francis Wolfright right here, and the tone he was struck was a very conciliatory one. Do you think there's a difference between the words they're saying in public and the attitude they're striking in private in these negotiations? Are the negotiations in good faith, if you start?
That's a good question.
What I say is that despite the long run negotiations are still going on, but the government has acted in a reckless and provocative manner in the way it's gone about these issues. After today's disruption, I urge both sides to get around the negotiating table, put aside the rhetoric, and stop this kind of thing happening again.
It's a statement you've made publicly, you might have known this before, obviously, but have you spoken privately to any union leaders and expressed your view to them on a personal level, would you say?
All I say in public and in private to everybody involved in this is get around the negotiations and stop this kind of action happening again. These strikes are wrong because negotiations are still going on, but parents and the public have been let down by the government as well, who acted in a reckless and provocative manner.
Your parents, my parents, are people watching your parents. Has it affected you personally, this action? Has it affected your family, your friends, I mean, and what is the net effect of that going to be on parents having to take their foot?
I think parents up and down the country have been affected by this action, and it's wrong at a time when negotiations are still going on. Parents have been let down by both sides because the government has acted in a reckless and provocative manner. I think that both sides should, after today's disruption, get around the negotiating table. First.
Yeah. You okay? I don't know how to kill this. So, what do you think's going on there? So, as I said, that was a pool interview. So, it wasn't live on television. But what that was message discipline, which is a big part of contemporary persuasion. Ed's good at it. So what he was doing there was making sure that, having worked out, maybe by interviewing people, maybe looking at poll numbers, working out what people needed to hear to get them to come around to his view, he made sure that did not get left on the cutting room floor. That, I can assure you that the strikes are wrong while the negotiations are still going on. Both sides, put aside the rhetoric, get around. That got through. That got on the news. And the thing is, politicians, you know what they're doing. beginning of the day, work out what messages they want out, fan out into the media, and get those messages out. On message politicians is what that is. The fact is, repetition is extremely persuasive. Slogans, jingles. The more we hear something, the more likely we are to believe it to be true. There's a thing called the illusion of truth effect. In loads of studies, the more often you hear something, the more likely you are to find it to be true. And Ed's making sure that you hear exactly what he wants you to hear. What's deeply painful about that is that an interview with a politician is no longer an opportunity to hold them accountable for anything. It's an opportunity for them to spin us more. George Bush said, a spectacularly unguarded moment, that his job was to repeat things over and over again to catapult the propaganda, which is what a lot of politicians are up to. I can read you very, very quickly what the interviewer said in a blog post after that. Damon Green is his name. He said, by the fourth question, having heard the same answer three times, I started to wobble. As he recalled afterwards in a blog post, I'm not sure what I asked next. Frankly, I was in danger of losing it. On my own, with the eyes of Ed Miliband and his three handlers boring into me, but apparently oblivious to my presence, I was getting twinges of what I can only describe as existential doubt. So I said some words, and Ed told me that the strikes were wrong. So, framing, fake news, message discipline, this is like a tiny taste of where persuasion is today, but I want to spend the little time I have left talking about what it's doing to us as individuals and as a people, as a culture. There's two philosophers I'll mention to you. One of them is Ruth Grant, and she's written a book called Strings Attached, Untangling the Ethics of Incentives, and it's pretty good. And she's interested in incentivizing as a kind of way of persuading people. I mean, incentive is just like a bribe, a way to get someone to do something by giving them something else, not talking them through it, not giving them good reasons. So plea bargains or paying a kid to cut the grass or something like that are incentives. And she said she has an interesting view about what this does to us. She says there's a kind of spillover effect. If you pay a kid to cut the grass, they're going to want money to do the washing up, too. When people are regarded, this is a quote, when people are regarded as self-interested incentive seekers, that's what they turn into. The more we're treated as one-dimensional creatures, motivated by selfish cost-benefit analysis and nothing else, the more we get used to an incentivized environment, she says. The assumption of incentives, that people are primarily motivated by calculations of benefits and costs, rather than things like doing something for your good reasons, becomes self-fulfilling. When we're treated like robots, we turn into robots. And incentives make us passive, self-interested, predictable, and manipulable. And I think her conclusions there can be generalized to all the kinds of non-rational persuasion that the persuasion revolution is pushing on us. The more we're nudged and anchored and incentivized, not reasoned with, the less reasonable we become. If reason is no longer kind of at the core of our values, we become less reasonable people. We put up with that. We put up with framing and spinning. We put up with anger and hate in the presidential debate rather than policies. Pan out for a second. Second philosopher I mentioned to you is Martha Nussbaum. She talks about, in a book called Not for Profit, she talks about what she characterizes as a crisis of massive proportions and grave global significance, another one. This time it's education. And she says that what we're doing now is we're training people with vocational studies, not teaching people how to think, not teaching people critical thinking. And as she puts it, the world is producing generations of useful machines rather than citizens who can think for themselves. I think she's dead right on that score. She devotes a chapter in the book about the importance of learning to argue in the Socratic tradition. Socrates saw himself as a gadfly stinging the sluggish horse of democracy into action. All these questions, trying to work out what's true, arguing with people together. And she says that democracy needs citizens with those kind of skills. Those citizens are not just important to democracy, they're constitutive of it. People who can follow an argument, understand fallacies, see through demagoguery, all that stuff, are vital. They're the self-defense that's at the heart of people power. And if we lose that, we lose everything it protects, and that's like it protects us mostly. She also suggests that this is part of the lack of respect we show one another now in public forums for debate and discussion. In the U.S., there's what Michael Sandel has called ideological food fights on the floor of Congress. People are incapable, with different opinions, are incapable of talking to one another without great anger. If it's having to do with religion, gun control, abortion, tax reform, all these things in America, people just butt heads, and they can't handle each other. They can't talk to one another anymore. There were bits on my Facebook newsfeed, God knows whether that's true, but it said that there were, you know, this is how you can talk to your family at Christmas. This is how to talk to your family when you have to see each other at Thanksgiving. You'll be okay, just don't mention this. Change the subject to that, because we can't talk anymore. And Nussbaum thinks that that's part of what's going on as we lose the ability to argue. No one seeks common ground in a football match, and arguments are like point scoring now. It's a football match, no less. But as we lose our ability to argue, our prospects for building an interconnected, peaceful world are going to diminish as well, she says. So let me end with a couple of things. One of them is just a glance at what contemporary political discourse is like at the moment, which I think is evidence for the idea that persuasion is changing in our culture. The New York Times has just published a complete list of the 279 people, places, and things Donald Trump insulted on Twitter. It runs to many pages, which is astonishing if you think it's 140 characters. Jeb Bush is a basket case, phony, weak, clueless. Ted Cruz is a loser, a choker, a nasty guy. These are all his Republican people in the Republican primaries. Rick Perry should be forced to take an IQ test. Barack Obama is insane, incompetent, ridiculous. Hillary Clinton gets the most attention. Before I lost the will to live, I counted 500 separate insults aimed just at her. Bad judgment, crooked, not qualified, fraud, dumb. There was collateral damage in so large a barrage. There were lots of things Donald Trump hit that maybe weren't people. Baseball, ridiculous. A podium in the Oval Office looks odd,
not good.
Clinton, I mean, I don't want to be one-sided. Clinton wrapped up her talk, her references to Trump's talk about assaulting women, until she very nearly lost her voice in the last days of the campaign. Trump called her a criminal, promised to lock her up. And certainly, a candidate's character matters to voters, and it should, but none of that had anything to do with things that will really matter to millions of human beings in the next 4 years and beyond. Climate change, abortion, all these things that should have been discussed. And people who know how argument works know that all of this is, philosophers call it an argumentum ad hominem, an attack on a person, irrelevant to the truth and falsity of what they say. Your opponent might be a liar or a bigot, but they still might be right about policy, and if they've got a good argument, you've got to listen to it. But none of these things were really focused on. None of these real policy matters were really focused on. And just as insult has begun to take the place of reasoned arguments, so have lies. And I'll just sort of accelerate a little bit so we can talk. Lies have a much bigger place in politics than they ever did. Lies have ended political careers. They don't anymore. Just very quickly, a fact-checking website called PolitiFact rated 144 of Clinton's claims as true or mostly true, found 40 to be mostly false, another 28 to be completely false, and 7 earned their lowest score, pants on fire, indicating what the site calls ridiculous lies. 47 of Trump's claims were true or mostly true, 166 were false or mostly false, 54 were in the pants on fire category. They monitored everything Trump and Clinton said over 5 days of campaigning, tweeting, interviews. They found that Trump averaged a lie every 3 minutes, 5 hours of speaking. Clinton did better, a lie every 12 minutes, but still there's lies. Why is that going on? Well, we can talk also about the budget, the Brexit debate in the UK, which itself was filled with this kind of stuff, which is false, and they knew it was a lie. $350 million was not going to be funded into the NHS. They knew it was. They knew a lot more money comes back from the EU into the UK. They persisted with the lie. The Remain camp lied too. They argued that Western political civilization in its entirety would end if the UK left the EU. So what explains all of this? So I think lots. I'll just say, some people point to new things in the world to try to explain what's going on in our political discourse. One of those new things you might think is technology, and maybe people are stuck in filter bubbles. Maybe we just talk to people like us, and that makes us turn inwards. That can make a country turn into this. That can make us talk past each other. Maybe that explains what's going on. Some people say that the financial crash is what's responsible. There's a really interesting German study that looked at 800 general elections over 140 years in 20 economies, and they found that after a serious financial crash, extreme right-wing parties increased the vote share by 30%. And that might be part of what's going on. Others say it's demographic shifts, and that might be behind the rise of populism and nationalism. And what we're one person argues that this is the death rattle of angry white men. That's what we're seeing. Add to that this slow motion change in persuasion that I think is going on. I don't think it's behind everything, but I think it's behind a lot of it. And I want to have some time to talk, so I'll just end with the personal question. So we talk about how this affects human character, how it is changing our politics. You should think about how it's affected you, right? So if you think about all the things you believe and imagine that you have a kind of God's eye view of where those views came from, the spider's web of how you came to think what you think, stretching back to wherever. And think about how much of that is the result of clear-headed reflection on your part, and how much of it is spinning, framing, just going along with what those around you think. I want to know what's mine and what isn't. Otherwise, you're not living your life. You're living somebody else's life, and there's something awful about that. I'll give you a quote from Bertrand Russell. He talks about the person, the man who has no tincture of philosophy, the unreflected person who just goes through life imprisoned in the prejudices derived from common sense, from the habitual beliefs of his age or his nation, from convictions which have grown up in his mind without cooperation or consent of his deliberate reason. Russell sees in that kind of life horror. It's the worst human life you could live, because again, it's not your life you're living if the principles you live by aren't your own, if you haven't chosen them critically and carefully and thought about it critically and carefully. I think the persuasive pressure on us to choose a kind of life is enormous, more than it was in Russell's day, but the stakes are as high as they always were, and it bothers me a lot, and I hope it bothers you too. Yeah. Good. So do some questions. I mean, it's a lovely
number bothered.
Oké, als iemand de nood heeft om een vraag te stellen en daarvoor een microfoon kan gebruiken, steek alsjeblieft uw hand omhoog. In Belgium, it's common courtesy to wait 2 minutes. This gentleman is prepared to talk about the rules, so thank you very much.
That's awesome.
Hi. I recently saw an interview or a reportage on the Dutch television, and it was about nudging as well, but they also mentioned that nudging is often mentioned in a negative way, and there was a guy who used to work for Google, I think, and he came up with a new kind of thing in thinking how nudging and the internet and social media can work in a positive way to get to your where you want to get in life. How do you think about that? Is it possible,
sure,
like to get Google to work out because they keep data of all of your interests and so on, that they maybe can work out a way to get to your goal, like where you want to get in life, where you want to get for a job, come up with propositions?
I don't know if I want Google to do it, but nudging, you're absolutely right, nudging can be a really beneficial thing. I mean, that's the promise, that's the hope. Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein in their book Nudge, both of those men went on to influence government in the States, and there's a nudge unit in the UK. And a lot of what they did, I think, was really, really valuable and really useful. So I know organ donation is a touchy one. But one of the things that I think happened in Austria is one nudge is setting defaults in a certain way. So if you set the choices up in one way rather than another, people tend to just stick with the defaults as they are. It's why you don't mess with your phone settings much. You just kind of go along with it. And so if you set up whether or not people are members of or on an organ donation list, as everyone's on unless you opt out, you get 99% of the people donating their organs. If you have to opt in, it's more like 5%. It's an effort, so people don't do it. I'm in favor of organ donation, so I think that's okay. But the thing I don't like about it is that the government did it. I don't like the idea that, a government might be really good at covert manipulation of its people. And so I also don't like the idea that a billion-pound company like Google might be able to manipulate people. I just don't like the idea that they can do that without us knowing about it, without oversight. But nudging can be really beneficial. It's really hard to work out the ethics of it. But yeah, I mean, totally. What else? Is somebody there?
I'll just scream.
Yeah, just scream.
If you describe the problem, so nudging or persuasion is used in awful ways, do you have some solutions or some tools that we can use to call out the persuasion bias?
I'm so glad you asked. Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I kind of wanted to end by saying I hope this bothers you, because I think the solution could be us trying to work out what to do. I think there are top-down solutions to the troubles that we face in understanding what persuasion is doing to us. And those are really hard levers to pull, things like change education. Like Nussbaum says, we need a revolution in education. We need to teach people critical thinking from an early age and carry on. Right? Keep doing it, because the techniques of people who persuade us change. We need to adapt. There used to be an Institute of Propaganda Analysis in the 40s, and it was for adults so that we could find out what people were doing and change their minds. So education is one. You could change the laws in certain ways so that, for example, a public relations firm that does something like swings an election or gets a country involved in a war, which may have happened in the 90s in the States, or allows tobacco companies to keep doing what they're doing, those sorts of things ought to be punishable in various ways. So there's these top-down things you can try. But I'm in favor of the bottom-up stuff. I'm in favor of us doing something. So I think that if we insist on good reasons, as you know, if enough of us do, that will change things. Sheer numbers always change things. And it's when there's a lot of people who can withhold assent unless you're given a good reason. That's a really hard thing to do. But if you can just not give in, and take great care when you vote, and start being willing to talk to each other again. I think that. So most political conversations tend to be, I'm going to try to convince you of what I think is true. And that is the best place to start. Even if they're nuts. Even if they're crazy. Even if they have crazy views. You've got to try to find common ground and work together in some way. Another thing, there's lots of things you can try to do. The problem is a lot of cognitive biases that we have. There's not much you can do about price anchors, you know. There's not a lot you can do about some of these things, but often if you get a friend, you know, who can help you through cognitive trouble, who can see things with you, you know, whenever you have to make a big decision, talk to somebody if you can. But yeah, I think there's loads of stuff, but it's something that we all should talk about and come to a conclusion. Good question.
I think we have room for one more.
Since you've talked about election and politics and information, the only political contribution people can really make is vote in one out of every 4 or 5 years. So the people don't have a lot of incentive to be informed or to care about the facts. Like, only these few months before an election, it really has the attention of the press and the attention of political parties. So in a way you could say it's a consequence of how democracy is organized. If you agree on that, how would you modernize democracy to build in more incentive for people to actually be informed and to care more about the facts?
That's one of the questions, isn't it? Somebody say, and I think they were joking, that what we should do is just every time there's an election cycle, just choose 10 people, and they vote. No one else does. And if you have that awesome responsibility, you find out everything you could. Just limit the number of people. I don't think it's a good idea. It is true that there's got to be some sort of change in... We've got to recognize, I had a go at Ed Miliband, but it's not just them. We've got to recognize that our civic duty has got to be something more than just clicking a petition or retweeting something. As citizens, we need to wake up. as well. And we should just be involved a bit at the end when we know they're trying to convince us. We should always be paying attention. And it's difficult to maintain that level of political interest. And not everybody is interested in politics anyway. But I mean, there have been other democracies who I think do it better than we have lately. And who inculcate, again, maybe that's an education thing, inculcate that thought that it matters a lot. And I might disagree with you about the thought that we only have an opportunity every 4 years to do something. I think there's all sorts of mechanisms that citizens have to make a noise and have some sort of input in the democracy. It's not just when you vote. There's other opportunities too.
Voting is a mandatory in Belgium.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that fantastic? I think I knew that.
Okay.
Does that work? Do you think, are people more politically engaged?
No.
No. Okay, I'll work on that the next time we go up on time.
So the bad news is that we have to wrap up, but the good news is that Mr. Garvey will be signing some of his books, including his last one, The Persuaders, at the book stand in the main hall entrance. But first of all, I would like you to give him a big round of applause.